There's only a small window of time in your cycle when you're producing cervical mucus. So the key to understanding your fertility is understanding mucus.
Welcome to the Mastering Your Fertility podcast. The show is all about reclaiming health, enhancing fertility, and preparing for pregnancy. We're Dr. Haley Nye and Kristen Cornett, your hosts and the creators of the online fertility platform, Tiny Feet. Now, at Tiny Feet, we take a very unique functional medicine approach to helping couples overcome fertility struggles, conceive successfully, and have healthy, thriving babies. We offer individualized consults that include functional lab testing and targeted naturopathic and nutritional therapies, as well as an online fertility assessment and online courses. And you can learn more about us on our website at tinyfeet.co. Now, before we get started, we want to give a shout out to one of our listeners for giving us an amazing review on iTunes. They wrote, "I just discovered your podcast this week and I've almost listened to all of the episodes. I love the balance of precise medical information and casual girl talk atmosphere. It's exactly what I needed and it really helped me at this point in my life. I literally just got diagnosed with SIBO yesterday after a diverticulitis attack a few months ago. So episodes 9 and 10 were great. Thank you for doing what you do, ladies." If you're listening, thank you so much for that amazing review. And we're so happy that you're finding benefit. And we sincerely hope that you find the healing that you're looking for. Now, for all our other iTunes listeners, please consider leaving us a quick rating or review. We would absolutely love to hear from you. And also, please subscribe so you're notified of new episodes every Wednesday morning. All right, let's jump into this week's interview. You're listening to episode 26, where we're going to be interviewing fertility awareness educator, holistic reproductive health practitioner, podcast host, and author, Lisa Hendrickson-Jack. Lisa is an expert on teaching women to chart their menstrual cycles, and she's going to talk to us about how we can track our fertile signs to increase our chances of a successful conception. In this episode, you're going to learn what the fertility awareness method is and how it's different from the Rhythm method, how to track your cycle to determine when you're most fertile, why cervical mucus is so amazing and how it helps you conceive, and how charting your cycle can help you identify when something is off with your health or your fertility. And if you want to get a better idea of whether you're having symptoms that are contributing to an imbalance, take our free quiz called, Are You Healthy Enough to Get Pregnant? So in this quiz, we help you evaluate for nutrient deficiencies, inflammation, poor gut health, hormone imbalances, and more. And you can find the link to download that quiz in the episode description. All right, so let's get started and introduce to you our wonderful guest this week. So Lisa Hendrickson-Jack is a certified fertility awareness educator and holistic reproductive health practitioner who teaches women to chart their menstrual cycles for natural birth control, conception, and monitoring overall health. In her new book, The Fifth Vital Sign, Lisa debunks the myth that regular ovulation is only important when you want children by recognizing the menstrual cycle is a vital sign. Drawing heavily from the current scientific literature, Lisa presents an evidence-based approach to fertility awareness and menstrual cycle optimization. She hosts the Fertility Friday podcast, a weekly radio show devoted to helping women connect to their fifth vital sign by uncovering the connection between menstrual cycle health, fertility, and overall health. Lastly, but not least, we are giving away a free copy of her book, The Fifth Vital Sign. So if you're listening to this episode before May 4th, 2019, you can enter to win by going to our Instagram page at tinyfeet.co. So that's tinyfeet.co and click on the podcast episode 26 post, and the instructions in there to how to enter are in the post description. So to make it even easier to win, we've linked directly to our Instagram account in the episode description. So go ahead and click on that link and then find the episode post with Lisa's shining face on it, and the instructions are right there. And this book giveaway will fly by very quickly, so be sure to get entered right away. We'll be announcing a winner first thing this Saturday morning, May 4th, on our Instagram stories. All right, that's it. We're going to jump right into the interview. All right, welcome, Lisa. Thank you so much for being on the Mastering Your Fertility podcast today. We are so excited to have you.
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Awesome. So the first thing we would like to know is how you came across Fertility Awareness Method and what inspired you. Like, I know that you've been doing it for over 20 years. Is that right?
Almost 20 years. So I discovered fertility awareness when I was really young. I think my experience is a bit on the unique side. Mm-hmm. I had chosen to seek the pill, and I was put on the pill when I was about 15, 16, because I had really painful, heavy periods, and I was a teenager. I didn't know what to do about it. But, you know, along that journey, I recognized that it didn't fix anything. You know, every time I would take a break from it, the pain would still be there. And so when I actually needed birth control, because I wasn't using it for birth control at the time, I just had this, like, I had a couple of reasons I didn't want to use it for birth control. So first of all, I wasn't using it for birth control before, so I'd never take it at the right time. And I had read the manual. I was a nerd back then. So I kind of knew I would always be a little bit nervous about if I took it an hour late or something like that. So I just didn't feel like it was the right thing for me. But also, because I had these really heavy, painful periods, I had a sense that, like, I always wanted kids at some point, not then, but I was nervous that there could be something wrong with me and I didn't want it to make it worse. So that was kind of like, oh, this doesn't work for me. So at the time I kind of decided, well, you know, I'm going to use condoms anyways, you know, for the sake of safe sex. So why don't I just only use condoms? And then I discovered fertility awareness kind of like right at that perfect time. And so I was on my university campus. I was in my like post high school feminist phase. And there was a talk. So a woman named Inga Musio wrote a book called Cunt, A Declaration of Independence, a really interesting book, obviously. And she came to read an excerpt of it. And I'm in the audience. And at some point, she talked about how there's a certain point in your cycle when you could get pregnant, you know, your cervical position changes, and you have this, you know, cervical mucus changes. And really, it was the first time I'd ever heard anybody say that you weren't fertile every single day. And so that was the moment, right, that sparked this whole, you know, journey of mine. But essentially, that encouraged me to go and read. You know, I got Taking Charge of Your Fertility. But then on my university campus, there just happened to be a group of women who met every month and who were trained in fertility awareness, and they were teaching it. So I started attending, and then I eventually, like, they just couldn't get rid of me. Eventually, I was also teaching. I took a training program when I was in my early 20s, and so I was teaching the method to women, and that has obviously blossomed into a career, like, full-blown all of this. So that's how I got into it.
Wow, that's amazing. And then you mentioned in your book that your mom and also your aunt had some similar struggles. Is that right? And then what happened with their health?
Mm-hmm. Well, my mom, she never had the pain, but she had ridiculous periods. So she had fibroids, which, you know, runs in the family, and, you know, a lot of Black women specifically struggle with fibroids. So it's kind of like I saw her experience it. It was so bad. You know, I've heard a lot of women with fibroids and, you know, talk about it this way. A lot of Black women in particular, that's just been my experience. But it's like, if they get big enough, it can get to a point where you literally, like, you put in a tampon and you're wearing a pad and, like, you stand up and it's over. You know, the bleeding can be so heavy. So, you know, eventually got to the point where, and of course, this was the 90s. So, you know, what do? You do a hysterectomy. So eventually that was the option that was presented to her. And she, you know, that was the only option that she felt would, and really given her options at the time, like that was the only option that made sense for her. And that was provided for her. So she had the surgery. My aunt came to stay with us. And then, you know, I was probably, who knows, 10. I was really young, but I was privy to these adult conversations. And so my aunt, you know, pulls up her shirt and she's like, this is my scar. They did it this way. I had the same thing happen. She was talking about her experience at work where she, you know, same thing, pad, tampon, goes to work and someone's like, you got a little something. So, so for me, and then, you know, I've just seen it in my family. Like it's a thing. I've, you know of some of the members of my family who had a difficult time conceiving or carrying. So there was always kind of like that, oh, am I going to have trouble conceiving? I mean, I made my doctor give me an ultrasound when I was in my early 20s. I also have fibroids, but because of all of the knowledge I've gained over the years and because I've been monitoring my menstrual cycle and all these things, staying away from xenoestrogen, you know what I mean? Like just doing all the things that I know of to minimize it from getting worse. They've never gotten worse. They've never gotten to the point where it's really affected me to that degree. I was able to have two children. You know, didn't affect my ability to conceive and carry. So this is what it is, right? Knowledge is power. If you're able to find out this information early and kind of step in and do things, you can really change the course of your life. Like my life could look a lot different.
Oh, absolutely.
Such an empowering message too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Lisa, can you tell us what fertility awareness method is and how it's actually different than using like apps OPKs on your phone or OPK kits
or the rhythm method.
The rhythm method, yeah.
Yes, no, that's a great question. Fertility awareness, I mean, first of all, you can think of fertility awareness as an umbrella term. So there's not one quote-unquote fertility awareness method. Under the umbrella term would be a number of different fertility awareness-based methods. So when you're, you know, speaking to fertility awareness educators, there's a lot of different training programs, a lot of different methods and practices and ways to do it. But the foundation is the same. So when you understand the way the menstrual cycle works, there's a certain window of time when pregnancy is possible. And that window, the reason that there's this short window is because there's only a small window of time in your cycle when you're producing cervical mucus. So the key to understanding your fertility is understanding mucus. So for anyone who's watching or listening who might not be aware of it, a lot of women have had the experience of mucus, but they may, you know, we're not taught about it, so they didn't know what was happening. So essentially, cervical mucus can look like clear, stretchy, raw egg whites, and it can also look like lotion, like creamy white hand lotion. So, you know, a lot of women may have had the experience in different ways. So some women might find that at a certain point of their cycles, you know, they go to the bathroom and they're wiping and it's like super slippery and you have to wipe a couple times, you know, but you might not think anything of it. Some women may have had the experience where they're like, they feel like wetness and they're like, oh my goodness, my period's here. And they go to the bathroom and there's no period. And other women end up in their doctor's office every month because they think they have an infection, right? So it's like they're seeing this discharge, and we all know discharge is associated with infection. Some women even end up on antibiotics, even though it's just their cervical fluid, right? So, but either way, cervical fluid is key to fertility because we've often heard that sperm can survive in our bodies, you know, for up to 5 days, but it's because of the cervical fluid, cervical mucus. So essentially, fertility awareness allows you to identify that short window of fertility, which technically is about 6 days in the cycle. So sperm can live in your cervical mucus for up to 5 days. That's what the research tells us. And then ovulation happens on 1 day. So 5 + 1 = 6. So technically, there are only 6 days of the menstrual cycle when conception is possible. So fertility awareness allows you to identify that phase. And of course, if you're using it actively for birth control, you're going to have to learn the rules and add a little buffer period around that. But essentially, if you don't have unprotected sex during the only point in your cycle when you can get pregnant, then you can't get pregnant. It can be something to get your mind around that there are certain phases of your cycle that you can actually have unprotected sex and that conception is impossible scientifically. You know, a lot of women really struggle with that. Mm-hmm. But that's essentially the basis of the method. And the reason that it's different to the rhythm method. So the rhythm method was based on more of a calendar calculation type of thing. And so a lot of the modern day charting apps are essentially an extension of the rhythm method. So it's based on that idea that if my cycle is usually, say, you know, 30 days, it'll always be 30 days. So I can just calculate when the fertile window will be. And then I can just kind of use that. Fertility awareness recognizes that women are not robots and ovulation is variable. And so I've been charting my cycle for almost 20 years. There have been times, you know, I've struggled with different health challenges myself. You know, I have a thyroid issue that was uncontrolled when I was in my early 20s. So my cycles at times were 45 days, you know, 50 days long. So obviously ovulation wasn't happening on day 14 for me at that time, but you know, over the years, it's, so I've seen it personally, my own cycles fluctuating. I've worked with clients. So you can still use fertility awareness effectively, even if your cycle fluctuates, because you're actually paying attention to your body's signs. You're not looking at a calendar. You're actually looking in your panties. And it's like, do I have mucus or not today? Am I fertile or not today? And so that's what makes it different. And that's why it's much, the rhythm method isn't an effective method of birth control for most women. But the research and evidence tells us that, so for example, the symptothermal method of fertility awareness, monitoring your cervical mucus patterns, your cervical position, and your basal body temperature shifts, has been shown to be, you know, upwards of 99.4% effective when used perfectly. So
when we're talking about fertility awareness method, the way that you use it, we're kind of talking about the combination of those three things. So basal body temperature, cervical mucus, and cervical position.
That's right.
Okay.
And so what I've been learning is that the cervical mucus really is like the star
of the show.
Exactly. And, you know, previously, years ago, I thought basal body temperature was, like, I thought that was the big thing. So I want to talk much more about cervical mucus. And one thing that I want to clear up is, like, what's the best way to test cervical mucus? You just mentioned it. You said something with the toilet paper and, you know, wiping backwards and maybe doing it before urinating. So tell us, like, over your vast amounts of experience, what's the best way to figure out the difference between, like, vaginal sloughing or maybe infection, or what is cervical mucus?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a really good question. And I think it's helpful to, like, especially for the listeners and the viewers, you know, there's a difference between having a general understanding of your body and just having a general knowledge of this is what's happening versus using this method for birth control. So for a woman who's literally just listening and it's like, whoa, this is really neat, but she's not, like, committed yet to using this as a birth control method, you could simply, so, you know, I don't have to tell anybody to wipe themselves when they go to the bathroom, you know, that's what we do. So one of the, just the basic things that you can do is when you go to the bathroom, you know, throughout your day, just be conscious of it. So when you're wiping yourself, literally, like, does it feel slippery at some times? Do you notice anything? Are there times when you see thing, you know, see an observation in your underwear? Have you ever seen kind of like creamy, lotiony type stuff in your underwear? Have you ever seen clear, stretchy in your underwear? Have you ever touched it, picked it up and see if you could stretch it? So just from that basic general understanding. And also some women might notice that there's a certain point in their cycle where they actually feel a little bit wetter. You know, it feels like there's something. I think a lot of us, if you're not on hormonal birth control that would suppress your cervical mucus observations, then you've experienced it. And you may not have been attuned to what it was, but there's definitely a period of time in your cycle when you kind of notice that. From more of a charting perspective, when you're wanting to actually identify and be really specific about it, I teach women to check for mucus using the external checking, basically. So you're taking a piece of flat toilet paper, and before you go to the bathroom, you're actually going to wipe across your vulva front to back, and you're going to wipe across your perineum, and you're going to pay attention, like, does it feel dry? You know, does the toilet paper feel scratchy, or does it feel smooth, or does it feel lubricative? Like, is it, like, really slippery down there? And then you look at the toilet paper and, like, is there anything on the toilet paper? You know, is there anything that you can pick up and test between your fingers? Or is the toilet paper just, you know, dry or shiny, or is there a damp spot or something like that? So to get into the more technical aspect of using it as a method, the way that I would teach my clients, you would actually want to be wiping before you go to the bathroom every time throughout the day. You know, after, you want to wipe as well. So you want to do, like, a second wipe after you go to the bathroom, because when you go to the bathroom, you're kind of engaging those muscles. And so if there is cervical mucus kind of hanging out inside of your vagina, you know, it'll be there. So, you know, from a more technical perspective, then your question of, like, how do you tell the difference between mucus and vaginal cell slough? So if you are wiping and you're kind of using that wiping method, if you're having just normal vaginal cell slough, for the, you know, the listeners or the, you know, the viewers who might not know what that means, you're just, like, when you take a bath every day, you know, you shed your dead skin cells and it's just a part of life. Your vagina is a self-cleaning, like easy bake oven, or I don't know if that's a bad example, but your vagina is a, you know, self-cleaning. And you know, we could go on about, like, douching is not necessary because your vagina does it, and there's a, you know, microbiome in there and, you know, all of that. But at the end of the day, your vagina sheds cells just like your skin does. So if you're wiping throughout the day, you'll notice maybe like a little shininess on the toilet paper or like a kind of a film, but nothing that you can actually like pick up and play with. It's just kind of like a film on the toilet paper. But when you actually have cervical mucus, you know, in your menstrual cycle, as you approach ovulation, you would be able to see it. You'd be able to pick it up. And, or I should also put out there that some women don't necessarily produce significant amounts of the peak kind of clear stretchy mucus. So some women, especially if they've had a long history of birth control use, or if they've ever had an issue with their cervix, if they've ever had HPV and had to have a cervical surgery or something like that, a cervical surgery would interfere with your cervical, like your cervix itself. So the cervix is the base of the uterus. It has all of these little fantastic folds where there are these specialized cells that produce our cervical mucus. And if you ever have a surgery that's going to scrape or, you know, remove a piece of your cervix, then that's going to impact your potential to produce cervical mucus. So just to put it out there, some women, their sign of fertility is really when they're wiping and it's just lubricative and they don't necessarily have like all this clear stretchy stuff. So did I answer the question?
Yeah. Well, okay. So I think what's really important to understand about cervical mucus as opposed to other methods of tracking is like, if you're just temping, you're not going to see ovulation before it happens. You're going to see ovulation after it happens. But cervical mucus actually allows you to identify that fertile window before you've confirmed ovulation.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons it's so important to fertility is that you actually understand when that window is, you understand when those best times are to have sex. And even if there's variations in your cycle, you can still catch that window when you have fertile cervical mucus, as opposed to temping and seeing ovulation kind of after the fact.
Well, and you mentioned kind of before you discovered how, like how cool cervical mucus is and how much there is to it and what a key role it plays in fertility, you know, you kind of thought basal body temperature was the main show, and both are important. Basal body temperature is extremely useful because, as you mentioned, it confirms ovulation. So it doesn't give you like a heads up or a way to tell you when it's going to happen, because the reason that you're taking your temperature. So again, if the listeners aren't that familiar, the basal body temperature, it's measuring your resting metabolism. And what's really interesting and cool for all the kind of science nerds like myself that love this stuff is that when you ovulate, you produce progesterone in significant quantities. And progesterone has a thermogenic effect on the body. So it actually increases your metabolism, you know, for the duration of your cycle. And then if you get pregnant, the metabolism continues to stay up because the progesterone levels would continue to rise. When you are not pregnant, you know, your progesterone levels drop and then you get your period. And so that's where the temperature is really helpful, because especially for women who are using this as a birth control method, once you've confirmed ovulation, if you understand the way the menstrual cycle works, as you approach ovulation, you know, your cervix is actually, it changes position. It actually becomes open. You can actually touch and feel that shift. The cervix becomes softer and you can feel like a dimple because it's open. But then after ovulation, your progesterone kind of shuts that down. So the cervix physically changes position inside of the vagina. It's typically lower, firmer, and that dimple is gone because it's now closed. And so that in combination with your temperature helps you to confirm. So then post-ovulation, it's impossible to get pregnant because there's no egg, cervix is closed, the vagina is acidic, meaning your vagina is a sperm killer outside of your fertile window, which is, I think it's really cool. Mm-hmm. And really refreshing after kind of a lifetime of being taught that we're fertile all the time and that we can get pregnant all the time, but never really understanding why that works. And so, you know, there's a lot of women who use fertility awareness, essentially basal body temperature only. There's a lot of women who don't have any unprotected sex before ovulation. So say from their period until they ovulate, and they wait until their temperature goes up and they only have unprotected sex afterwards. And there's nothing wrong with that, because you still have the ability to avoid hormonal birth control, to have an effective method of birth control, because you can't get pregnant in that stage of your cycle. I would say the one challenge is that you end up losing a lot of that pre-ovulatory phase. You know, the whole pre-ovulatory phase would then be off limits. So understanding your cervical mucus allows you to recognize the actual length of your fertile window. And so it would free up some of those pre-ovulatory days for sex, especially for women who don't want to always be using a barrier or always want to be avoiding sex if they're using this method. But, you know, beyond that, it's important just in the general sense. Like if you recognize the role of mucus, when you're ready to have a baby, when you're ready to start conceiving, mucus is really important to pay attention to. And so understanding that helps kind of in all areas.
Yeah. I love that. So let's talk about that a little bit more. So in the luteal phase, you're saying that the cervical mucus is more hostile to the sperm. It's like a sperm killer, right? And there's like a plug in the cervix to just shut down any entry of sperm into the uterus. So it's impossible to get pregnant. What about the ovulatory phase or the follicular phase? Yeah. Is there's an E type of mucus, estrogenic type of mucus. And how does that actually help the sperm get into the uterus and get to the egg?
Yes, no, that's a great question. And so there's two broad categories of mucus, E type and G type. So type E, estrogenic, meaning that we're producing this, you know, when our estrogen levels are rising. So our cervical mucus production is directly related to our hormone production. And then the G type, gestagenic, meaning under the influence of progesterone, that's what we're producing when we have, like when we're not in the fertile window, when our progesterone levels are high. So when you're charting your cycle, so for a woman who's actually charting and she's, you know, she's using the toilet paper, she's wiping all the time, you know, what she's going to notice is that outside of her fertile window, it's going to actually be dry. So when we talk about G-type gestagenic mucus, what happens is it actually fills your cervix with the plug that you mentioned. So it's just, it's essentially not coming out. It's blocking the cervix. So you can think about it like a gate. It's the cervix has been described as a biological valve, right? Like it's either open or closed. And so when you, after ovulation, for example, your progesterone rises and it causes your cervix to fill with this plug. So it's literally like a nightclub or something and you've got a bouncer out front. No one's getting it. And so when you're in your fertile window, so to paint the picture, you know, you have your period. And then once your period, you know, stops, you'll typically have a couple days before you start to see cervical mucus, although you might see it earlier if you happen to have an early ovulation. So, you know, you'll typically have a few days where it's dry. So that plug is still firmly in place. But as your estrogen levels rise, it stimulates those crypts to start, you know, producing mucus and it kind of dissolves that plug. Some women will start to see the lotiony type, non-peak type mucus. So like it looks like creamy white hand lotion. And then they go into seeing the clear, stretchy raw egg white type. Some women just go straight to the clear, stretchy raw egg white type. And so the reason that it's so crucial for sperm survival and fertility is a couple of different reasons. So cervical mucus has this incredible quality of rapidly transporting sperm right into the cervical crypt. So it's kind of like a highway. And I was looking at some research to kind of see like how quick is it? And so in some of the research, they're kind of looking at how quickly it, or how long it takes for the sperm to kind of get into the cervical crypts or to get into the fallopian tubes. And sperm has been found in the fallopian tubes, you know, 5 to 10 minutes after exposure. So after ejaculation or insemination. So we often think it's that kind of warrior story, right? Real masculine, like the sperm are driving home or whatever, like they're the hero of the story. No. What happens is the sperm kind of just do their thing, like, you know, they've got their little tails and they're flagging along, but our cervical mucus actively transports them, rapidly transports them directly into the cervical crypts. And actually our uterus has those smooth muscle contractions that draw the sperm up. So it's our bodies that are doing the work to get the sperm to where it needs to go. So your cervical mucus has, there's different in the book, as you know, I know you read a bunch of that, the cervical mucus chapter, it's really interesting, but you know, we can break that down even further. When we're seeing that cervical mucus, there's different types. So there's like S mucus and P mucus and L mucus. But for the listeners, to talk about those specific aspects of it, a certain type of mucus, S mucus, draws the sperm rapidly into the cervical crypts. The cervical crypts inside the cervix are kind of like little holding cell. So it's kind of like a little hotel for them, you know, mm-hmm. It's like the perfect pH. They've got some energy and nutrients to keep them going. And it almost sounds like I'm making it up, but the mucus draws the sperm into the cervical crypts. And one of the examples I like to share is that because the sperm can survive in your body for 5 days, Mother Nature has designed this system so that the sperm are already there before ovulation happens. So let me create like a scenario for you. So you have sex on Monday, you have this wonderful, you know, clear stretchy mucus, and you have sex on Monday, you're trying to get pregnant, so you're not using protection. And so this mucus draws the sperm into your cervical crypts. And they can actually hang out in there for a couple days, and you know, you produce a different type of mucus as you get close to ovulation that actually opens the cervical crypts and kind of pushes the sperm up into the, you know, uterus and fallopian tubes around the time of fertilization. So let's say you ovulate on Friday. So you had the sex on Monday, and then your partner had to go fly somewhere. And so Monday was the sex, you ovulate on Friday. Well, the sperm is still alive, you know, because it can survive in your mucus up to 5 days. And it's actually already waiting in the fallopian tube, so that when you ovulate, you know, the eggs kind of, it's like you were, they were waiting for the main, the, they were waiting for the guest of honor. So I think I've started to explain it that way, because we live in a culture where when women are trying to get pregnant, there's this idea like you have to have sex on ovulation day. And so you have all these women peeing on all the ovulation predictor kit, strips. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but it's helpful to combine that knowledge with the knowledge of your mucus. Because if you wait to try to time in on ovulation day, you could be missing out on a whole week of great cervical mucus that is specifically designed to get the sperm where it needs to go, not to mention sperm quality. So I'll just take a quick jaunt to say, I don't think a lot of women know that even the healthiest man alive, so let's like the healthiest man alive, you know, stud, he's got the most amazing sperm, the majority of his sperm are still abnormal. Like even the healthiest man alive, like at least half of his sperm can't even fertilize an egg. What is considered normal morphology by the World Health Organization is 4%, meaning out of every 100 sperm, 4 are normal. And the other 96 have a range of abnormalities like 2 heads, no head, 2 tails, no tail, malformations, et cetera, literally cannot fertilize an egg. So your cervical mucus actively filters out bad sperm in 2 different ways. The sperm that are malformed, 2 heads, no heads, all of that stuff, there's a type of mucus that has these specific protein structures that attach to those sperm and basically prevent them from getting through. And also your cervical mucus is thick enough that if the sperm has poor motility, like can't swim properly, that they can't actually actively swim through. So your mucus also, like, isn't that crazy?
It's so cool.
And there's still more. Like we could talk about mucus the whole time, but we won't. But I'm just saying, like, this is information we all need to know.
It totally is. From a fertility perspective, I mean, understanding that this isn't just some random event, you know, cervical mucus isn't just some random event where, oh, you wipe a couple of days a week, you know, in your cycle and, oh, it's kind of slippery. Like that's cool or not cool, depending on how you look at it.
And you don't have an infection.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is a major sign of fertility, and you know, having good cervical mucus is a sign of good fertility for a woman, but it can also be a problem for men who don't have normal sperm morphology and motility, which I think is probably a pretty common reason to do IUI, you know, when you've kind of confirmed that everything is okay from an anatomical perspective, or you haven't found any reason for infertility with a woman and you've identified an issue with sperm quality. I think that's a major reason for IUI, is you're trying to bypass the cervical mucus's ability to filter out those abnormal sperm. But really, that's what you want. I mean, you want your body to be able to do that. Right. You don't kind of want subpar sperm being able to fertilize an egg when your body would have prevented that.
Speaking of, in your book, Lisa, you talk about the difference between the IUI and a cervical cap, and how the research is actually very similar as far as it producing a pregnancy
Can you talk about that real quick since Kristen brought it up? And then I have another question about cervical mucus, of course.
Well, I mean, as a fertility awareness educator, there's always been a part of me that's like, because I understand the role of cervical mucus and how important it is. So there's always a part of me that's like, is IUI really the best solution? Really, in the book also, I talk about the success rates and the difference between pregnancy rates and live birth rates and the differences between, say, Clomid versus Letrozole, where Clomid is associated with higher rates of miscarriage, you know, versus Letrozole. And also, just in general, just to put it out there, in the best case scenario of a woman who's like 22, she's got a 25% chance of that IUI working. You know, a lot of women are getting IUI in their mid-30s and 40s, and the most significant factor in terms of how successful IUI is going to be is her age, so the age of her egg. And realistically, when we're in our 30s and 40s, the chance of IUI working is closer to maybe 10 to 15%, you know, per time. And that's why you'd have to kind of do it multiple times. Whereas with the cervical cap, so it's a completely different paradigm. So just for the listeners that are kind of like, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. It's like a home insemination. And with a cervical cap, you would actually be depositing the semen into the cap, and putting the cervical cap goes on the cervix. And so the theory behind that is that you're actually prolonging the exposure of the sperm to the cervical mucus to allow for that natural filtration process to go through. I always picture in my mind, so, you know, I mentioned that according to the World Health Organization, if a man has 4% morphology, that is completely fine. And 4 out of every 100. So if a man has like millions of sperm, how would those 4 get through, right? Like the out of the 100. So I just picture it. So this would allow time for this to physically happen. But I have to address the elephant in the room problem. You know, there's an issue with men and fertility. conception can happen really easily. So to put it into perspective, you know, you've got a healthy couple, a 20-year-olds or whatever. Conception can happen so easily. If sperm... And, you know, if you have a healthy body, healthy egg, healthy cervical mucus, healthy sperm, it shouldn't be difficult. When there's a challenge, when you're having to go to these extreme lengths to try to conceive, there's something going on, you know, because, for example, like when women are trying to conceive, it's really common for us to like put our legs up, you know, after sex to kind of hold it in, to try to keep it in. But those types of things don't really address the issues. So, you know, if you know that your partner has an issue with sperm quality, the cervical cap option is a good one. And based on the research, it's equally effective to IUI when done multiple times. It's a lot cheaper, but you would also have to do it based on the fertility awareness techniques of timing, because it's not going to help you if you're not doing it during your fertile window. But it does allow the prolonged exposure of your sperm to your mucus and increase the number of those good, healthy, quality sperm to actually make their way into the fallopian tubes and have a shot at fertilizing an egg. But if you're doing that, if you're going to that length because you know there's an issue with sperm quality, you got to also address the issue with sperm quality. You know, you got to start having him make some changes, because there's a lot of evidence-based ways to improve sperm quality.
So improve sperm quality, and then potentially do a cervical cap at home could be just as effective as doing multiple IUIs.
If not more.
Right. And also with the cervical cap that you mentioned, is what's interesting is same-sex couples to women doing using sperm, donor sperm in a cervical cap instead of going to IUI over and over again is an interesting and maybe more affordable option for them too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and if they have access, so depending on where mm-hmm. they live in the world, if they're able to get their hands on some sperm, mm-hmm. then having the ability to do that, again, with the fertility awareness techniques, so paying close attention to your cervical mucus, potentially, you know, considering doing an ovulation predictor kit in conjunction with mucus so that you're really kind of timing it at the best time of your cycle. And it allows you to do it in the privacy of your own home. One of the things I should mention is that, you know, I gave the example of women laying on your back. So if you've ever had sex with a man who has ejaculated inside of your body, even if you lay on your back, it comes out. You know, it's not effective unless you have a harness in your bedroom that holds you upside down. Like, I don't have one of those.
So I don't have one of those either.
No. So when you use cervical cap, it's holding it where it needs to be, and you can keep it in for, you know, 6 hours. So it's more of a, like a practical, legitimate, and there is research, so evidence-based way of actually extending that exposure, because we don't really have a practical, useful way to do that otherwise. Like the laying on your back thing, sorry, ladies, like that's not doing it.
Okay, so back to cervical mucus. Okay, so we talked about a lot of things with it, but I wanted to address two specific things. Is first, how do you know if your cervical mucus maybe isn't ideal? Like there's infection or potential like cervical dysplasia that you need to address. And then also, how does cervical mucus change with age?
Oh, love those questions. So first of all, I think understanding what healthy mucus looks like. So healthy cervical mucus, if you're charting your cycle and you have a general understanding of your cycle, you would expect to see cervical mucus, you know, after menstruation as you approach ovulation. So part of it is understanding when in your cycle you're supposed to see it. So you're not supposed to see mucus every single day. That's kind of the first thing. And so in your fertile window as you approach ovulation, you would expect it to be like that hand lotion analogy, but like creamy white in color. And if you're seeing kind of like the clear stretchy, or even if it's like cloudy or clear or stretchy, it is liquidy. It shouldn't be like, you know, the goo at the back of a credit card that kind of you have to pull and it's kind of like gummy.
It should be like that.
Yeah. So if it's gummy like that, or if it's yellow, if it's off colored, it shouldn't smell. I mean, we all know that there's an aroma to vaginas, but it shouldn't be unpleasant. And especially if you're aware of your typical normal aroma, if you notice like a drastic change to where it does smell off-putting or fishy or something like that, that can be a sign of like bacterial vaginosis or something like that. If you have itchiness, if you have irritation, and then also if you have a shift. So for example, through charting, you know, I've supported clients to identify really subtle, like there's like a spectrum. You don't necessarily go to a full-blown yeast infection, right? Sometimes it's just subtle, a subtle overgrowth of yeast where all of a sudden you're having some degree of this lotion every day. You know, like every single day, that can be a sign where, and also if there's that shift from having it just at that one point to having it kind of all the time, I'm trying to think of, and then that yellow color. So if I've worked with clients who they're charting their mucus and they notice that it's often yellow, and I don't mean once, if you have an issue with infection or something, you're going to see it consistently, you know, throughout your cycle and then the next one. It typically is a more of a consistent pattern. So when I work with clients and they're seeing yellow like frequently, multiple cycles, for some clients, literally just the yellow mucus was the only sign of an infection. So I kind of send them to the doctor, you know, just ask, tell them you saw some concerning looking discharge, right? That'll do it. Okay. They get themselves tested. And then for some women, just that is the sign. In terms of cervical dysplasia, you know, what that is abnormal cell development on the surface of the cervix. And so what that seems to do is cause a very liquidy, watery type discharge. So the discharge, and I'm using that word kind of intentionally, but the discharge that you would see if you have cervical dysplasia, it's not the same as cervical mucus. It is typically wet and watery. And there's a spectrum, because again, not everybody starts with stage four. There's this huge spectrum. And cervical, you know, cancer and abnormal cervical cells is a slow growing, I mean, you know, it's one of the slower growing types.
Yeah, it can take 10 or 20 years.
Exactly. So with charting, especially when you're using the wiping method, you're picking up on certain subtleties that you wouldn't otherwise. So for some women, they're just on the very beginning of that scale, you know, it hasn't become a full-blown problem yet. And so when they're wiping themselves, they may notice that it's never really dry. You know, the toilet paper is always damp and it's not pee, you know, because they're wiping before they go to the bathroom. So, you know, this is something, if it's an issue, you're going to notice it throughout the cycle. So even, you know, you're going to experience more of a kind of a wet lubricative type sensation when you're in your fertile window. But I'm talking before that and after that. After you've already ovulated, it's still damp. or the toilet paper, it's always wet. And depending on how far a woman is on that spectrum, you know, I've worked with a number of clients who will feel like a gush of what feels like water. So they're trying to live their lives and all of a sudden it's like, psh, and it's not their period. And when this is an issue, again, it's not just in their fertile window. They've ovulated already and they're getting these gushes post-ovulation. It's not mucus, it's something different. So for women who may be resonating with that or have noticed something like that, it's a good idea just to get a screen, ask your doctor to test you for dysplasia, because for some women that's literally like their only sign. And for women, I'll just point out as well that for I've worked with clients who are on that lower end of the spectrum that are seeing this consistent dampness, but it's not these gushes, so it hasn't progressed. And sometimes they see the signs before the test is positive.
Interesting.
Yeah. So then age, how does age affect cervical mucus quality or consistency or production?
Yes. No, I love that. I don't think I've had the opportunity to like talk about cervical mucus in depth in an interview. So this is a lot of fun. So again, another piece of our information about our fertility that we're not really privy to is that our cervical mucus production does change with age. And what that means is that for, and part of it too is I've been talking a lot about the cervix and the cervical crypts, those little folds within the cervix. And it's interesting because depending on how deep you want to get into this, there's different crypts that produce different types of mucus and they're located, like if you think of the cervix, everybody can't see my hands. I always teach with my hands. But if you think, of the cervix, it's the base of the uterus. And so there's certain types of crypts kind of closer to the opening and there's certain crypts kind of like, so just picture it kind of like a cylindrical tube. And so say at the base of the cervix, you tend to have more G crypts that are producing the cervical fluid that would make the plug. And kind of closer towards the top, you'd have different types of crypts. So just kind of picture that. So when you're in your early 20s, you have a lot more of the S crypts. So S mucus is what gives mucus its, you know, clear, stretchy, lubricative qualities, and you just have more of those crypts that are producing that type of mucus. So it wouldn't be uncommon for a woman in her late teens, early 20s, who's not on hormonal birth control to have, say, more like 7 or 8 days of peak quality mucus and have more of it. So perhaps if she's doing the wiping method and checking throughout the day, she has several days where she sees it 4 or more times. So she's wiping and she's seeing, it's like quite a bit. And as we get older, our cervix, it just ages, and it's nothing, there's nothing bad. It's just a part of life. And so we end up having fewer of the S crypts and gradually gaining more of the G crypts. So just meaning that by the time you're in your, you know, late 20s, maybe early 30s, you're still going to see cervical mucus as long as you're healthy and everything is good. But maybe you see fewer days, more like 4 to 5 days. And, you know, maybe you still see it more than 4 times a couple of days, but you don't necessarily have like 5 days where you're seeing it like 4 or 5 times a day all the time. By the time you hit your late 30s, early 40s, and kind of mid 40s, it's not uncommon for you to have fewer days still. So whereas you may have had, you know, 4 or 5 days earlier in your life, you may be down to having 2 or 3 days. And maybe you only have 1 day where you even see the clear mucus. And I mentioned that some women no longer have the high quantity. So for some women, they only have that sensation of lubrication when they're wiping themselves. So just to put it out there, like, this is normal. And I think that from my perspective as a fertility awareness educator, one of the messages I always share with my clients is that, you know, from the perspective of like trying to conceive and identifying which days are fertile or not fertile, there's no point in talking about more or less fertile, because you can't be more or less pregnant. Like, you're either pregnant or not. So from a timing perspective, even if you are that 43-year-old woman who really only has signs of mucus on 2 days, and all your only sign is that sense of lubrication when you're wiping, that's a fertile day. So you could think of the challenge as identifying that day. If you're 43 or 44 and you only have 1 or 2 days of mucus, you know, if you're just randomly having sex, what are the chances that you're going to hit that day? So just to give hope, like, regardless of how much mucus you see or how, what the quantity is and how many days, when you're thinking of fertility awareness for timing purposes, it's not about how much. It's literally about identifying when you have it and having sex on those days.
Yeah, well, that's really hopeful and really helpful information for women, especially those that are kind of, you know, creeping up into that more advanced maternal age category. So I want to shift gears a little bit that we can still talk about cervical mucus in the context of this next question. But we already talked about how some abnormal mucus that we might notice or abnormal discharge can sort of point to an underlying issue with infection or abnormal cells on the cervix. What other potential underlying health issues could women identify through this process of charting? So what could they find, you know, if there's issues with basal body temperature, either it's low throughout the cycle or they're not getting that spike after what should theoretically be ovulation. What other things can we glean from this that would kind of make us go to our doctors and say, hey, I think I have a problem with this?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a wide range. I think one thing to say is that with charting, it can be used as a diagnostic tool depending on how you're charting, but it's not like you're going to look at the chart and be like, aha, you definitely have this problem. You're looking for trends and then doing your research to kind of identify what that is. So for example, you mentioned basal body temperature. I mean, when you're taking a measure of your resting metabolism every day and it's like literally on your chart in front of your face, if your metabolism is super low, then you'll notice that. You know, if you have a chart, regardless of whether it's on an app or a piece of paper, if your temperatures are like off the chart, so low, then that's an important sign. So, you know, thyroid issues, that's an example of something that many women have discovered through charting. And it can be a combination of having those low temperatures as well as other what I call kind of low hormone parameters. So the first thing is to understand what a healthy cycle looks like. So in a healthy cycle, you would expect, you know, you have your period, day one of your cycle is day one of your period. You would expect your period to last anywhere from 3 to 7 days. Your period should have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and then it should be over. So if you're having lots of spotting before the period or after, or spotting throughout your cycle, you know, that's an indication that that's something you should be looking into. And as I mentioned, you typically would have a few days before you start to see cervical mucus. And then in a healthy cycle, you would expect to see mucus anywhere from, you know, 2 to 7 days. And then it's a similar thing, like your mucus should start, there should be a beginning, middle, and an end, and it should end in ovulation. ovulation, obviously, in a healthy cycle, ovulation has to happen. The overall length of a cycle can vary. And so a healthy cycle can range anywhere from 24 to 35 days. When you're getting up to the 35, 34 day range, you know, you are kind of pushing the upper limit of normal. So you know what I mean? Like you kind of want to watch that if it's really consistent, but it's helpful to know that it doesn't have to be 28 days and women are not robots. So very few, if any, women have 28 day cycles all the time. It's not a real thing, just to shatter
like a
that.
Myth perpetuated by birth control, right? You talk about that in your book.
Yeah, just like there's no Easter Bunny, there's no woman on earth that's ever had a 28 day cycle throughout her entire reproductive life. So, you know, when you start your period, your cycles are typically fluctuating a bit more. And then prior to menopause, our cycles are also fluctuating. So that is just a myth. But having that general sense of what is normal. So for example, PCOS is a quite a clear example of how charting, you know, I've supported women through charting identify PCOS. And there's always a part of me that's like, but it's so obvious. Like you only had 6 periods this year. No one ever thought to ask, you know, your doctor never asked to check your testosterone levels. And I had a client tell me that she asked about PCOS and her doctor told her that she is too skinny. So it couldn't possibly be PCOS because she wasn't overweight. And I was like, ah! which is a whole other issue, but
it is. Yeah. Well, we talked to Laura Bryden about that a couple weeks ago. So yeah. Anyway, sorry.
But with the chart, it's like, it's super obvious in that respect, if it's completely out of range, or if you're not ovulating, like in the case of hypothalamic amenorrhea or something like that, there's no mucus, you're not ovulating. It's pretty clear that there's an issue. But it's interesting because there's other, basically when I say, you know, that the menstrual cycle is like a vital sign, essentially what I'm saying is that menstrual cycle is mirroring what's happening. So other things show up in the cycle. So stress, for example, and we have acute stress and chronic stress. So acute stress, for example, if you have, something going on at work or an issue with your boss or something like that, or just something that happens that's really stressful at a certain time. If that stress occurs before ovulation, you might notice that it delays your ovulation by a couple of days and you end up with a longer cycle. Or you end up seeing mucus, like as if you were going to ovulate, but then you didn't, and then you see mucus again. So kind of like a double mucus patch situation. Post-ovulation for women who experience extreme stress, or maybe they pull out crazy exercise routine that's stressful on the body, they may notice some days of spotting before their period, or that their luteal phase, the second half of the cycle, shortens. And chronic stress is interesting as well. And when I say chronic stress, I don't necessarily mean like emotional stress. If you have a serious gut problem and you have sensitivities to certain things and you're consuming those things and it's causing chronic inflammation in your body, or there's a lot of, so when I say chronic stress, sometimes there's literally an issue like that that's causing inflammation in your body that's underlying, which is causing this kind of state of stress in your body. Or if you have an underlying infection that your body's fighting off that you didn't know, you know, Epstein-Barr, Lyme or something like that, then I've seen patterns that I refer to as kind of like a low hormone profile, where it's like you know, perhaps your period is a little bit on the short or light side, perhaps your cervical mucus seems really scant, like a little too scant, perhaps your temperatures aren't necessarily as high as they should be post-ovulatory, and then perhaps you have kind of signs of low progesterone. So essentially, it's really tempting to think as women that because our menstrual cycles are very personal, and it's really tempting to think that you should be able to look at your own cycle and like know it all. But, you know, it took me years to develop this specialized knowledge as well as training. So when you're looking to actually look that deep into the menstrual cycle as a diagnostic tool, you do want to look for the support of somebody who is trained to identify that, to help you to ask those questions and connect those dots. Because it's not just so straightforward. It's a combination of what you're seeing in the chart along with what the woman is experiencing. So you can kind of piece two and two together to figure out what it could be.
Yeah. I mean, we get questions sometimes like, oh, I've been tested and I have low progesterone. You know, what do I do about it? It's like, well, we have to figure out what's causing that, right? Because there are a lot of potential things that could be causing, you know, poor quality corpus luteum, or, you know, excessive cortisol production, or food sensitivities and inflammation. There's a lot of different potential underlying causes. But I love the idea of being able to use this information as kind of like a tool that we can use to look at our symptoms and to look at what's happening in our lives and to look at what's happening in our cycle and kind of say, okay, what might be going on here? And, you know, it's so empowering to have this information, to have this knowledge, because it's not something that we're taught. I think there's this kind of prevailing belief that we're just not smart enough to understand our own cycles, or that, you know, fertility awareness method is too difficult. You know, women don't want to do that. They don't care. They just want to pop a pill. And I mean, I would have at least liked to have had the option to make that decision. I didn't even have the option. Yeah. I mean, it was like birth control or nothing.
Yeah.
When I was trying to prevent pregnancy. And then when you get off of birth control, there's still so few resources to teach you about what's normal. You know, I had a hard time getting off of birth control. I have talked about that before on the podcast, but there weren't very many resources for me to figure out, okay, what is it that's really happening in my cycle? What are these signs pointing to? What should I be asking my doctor about? You know, when you get a 7 to 15 minute office visit with your OBGYN, you don't have time to address all of your questions. Even if you thought to ask them all, they wouldn't have time to address them all for you. So this is just another empowering tool that we can use to start asking better questions to our physicians, learning more about our bodies, and really, you know, for lack of a better term, taking charge of our fertility.
Well, absolutely. And one thing, as you were talking, one of the, I think, the most empowering and interesting ways that learning fertility awareness and charting, what I see in my clients is just that ability to recognize that you have so much power to positively or negatively impact your cycles and your overall health. And I think it's easy to take for granted how certain lifestyle type changes can impact. I think it's easier to want to, you know, reach for a supplement. I'm not like anti-supplement, but it's often easier to fill your cabinet with supplements versus going to bed on time.
Yes.
Versus addressing. So for example, when you mentioned the low progesterone issue, well, you know, there's so many different reasons why your progesterone could be low. you know, and it might not even be low, you know, did you test at the right time of your luteal phase? But like, there's so many different issues with that. And so it's a lot easier to look for supplements and all kinds of stuff than to actually address like, okay, so, but why are you working 70 hours a week? Like, when was the last time? How much coffee are you drinking exactly? Like, is it 3 or 4 cups a day? You know, are you still smoking? Is that a thing for you right now? Like, it's so much easier to look for all of those little things. So what I found in my practice is that I don't have to say a whole lot. I just ask questions like, you know, so what if we just cut the coffee for one cycle and see what happens? Blink, blink. And you can see for yourself. And yeah, that really gives you a lot of power, because what I think that we underestimate is just how much we can impact our cycles. I did an episode a couple of months ago to share. I did a little experiment on myself. I'm not ashamed to say that for a lot of years, I was addicted to sugar. You know, when I was a teenager, it's like disclosure time. When I was a teenager, like, gummy candies were a food group. You know, I'm sure that had something to do with my raging period pain, right? And so I have, over the years, you know, cut down a lot of my sugar consumption, but I did a little experiment with myself. I kind of cut out some of the additional areas of sugar that I was consuming. I replaced some, you know, sweeteners with like stevia, for example, that don't raise your blood sugar, just out of curiosity. And when I finished my experiment, I had gained like an extra day of my luteal phase. So my luteal phase has been fairly consistent, you know, throughout all these years of charting. And I had my first 14-day luteal phase like ever, just by cutting out the sugar. So sometimes we just don't think that, like, you want to find the pill that's going to improve your progesterone, but like, or you could look at your stress, look at how many times a week are you exercising again? Like, are you exercising like 5 times a week? Like, all of these things we don't realize could be stressing our bodies out, that could be making a bigger impact than the supplement.
I actually have a very similar story. I was thinking about that when you were telling your story, but when I was doing the preconception care before I ended up conceiving my baby, back in April of 2017, I usually have a shorter cycle, like 26 days. And even before I learned all about fertility awareness method and all that, I thought, oh, that just feels a little short to me. And so I started fertility smoothies. Well, I didn't really call them fertility smoothies. I basically had a green smoothie in the morning. And so I would put things like maca in there and spinach and flax seeds and all the things. And I did that for a good month, probably even 2 months, for a while, really consistently. And I too gained a day. I started having 27 and even 28 day cycles, which was really cool. And so back then, it was really apparent to me that changing my diet, changing my sleep habits and lowering my stress and all that really does, you can actually see the difference just based off of your cycle length and reduction in PMS symptoms, like reduction in bloating, reduction in pain, less headaches, less back pain. It's really cool.
Yeah, it is. Well, and I kind of have the opposite story of cutting down significantly on the length of my cycles, because I used to be that person that was so stressed out all the time. Like, I would sometimes not ovulate until day 20 or later of my cycle. Now, I'm still working on having a normal luteal phase, but I've at least cut down to the point where I have a much more normal follicular phase. I'm ovulating at what would be considered a normal time in my cycle, and my overall cycles are normal length. I'm just still working on that last bit of progesterone. But you know, it's difficult. It's a journey. Sometimes you can make really easy changes and in one cycle you see a difference. And sometimes these things take a little longer depending on where you're starting from, depending on what your health is like. Sure. But I love the message that we have the power to make changes. And sometimes it's not, I need to go to the doctor and get a medication, or I need to go to my naturopath and get a supplement. We're all about supplements too. I mean, there's tons that are helpful. We tend to start with much more basic, like, hey, let's make sure you have enough nutrients to support your cycle and make a baby. And then, you know, if maybe somebody's a little older or specifically struggling with egg quality, we'll recommend some things, but we're really about kind of figuring out, like, what is that root cause? And how can we fix that? Whether it's a diet thing, a lifestyle thing, a food sensitivity thing. And some people, it's like hard to make that connection for why we start there, because we're so used to that sort of allopathic way of treating things that's, oh, you have this issue, you take this pill, whether it's a supplement or a medication.
Yeah. Well, and it's with the cycle, it's exactly what you said. You have this tangible display, essentially, of what's going on, and it gives you feedback. I think that's one of the reasons why I'm always so jazzed about it, because it really gives you the ability to see. So, for example, especially when there's a harder conversation there, you know, like when you know you're not in the career of your dreams, I'm picking on jobs, but it's a good example, because that's something that I've seen a lot, where you kind of knew that your intuition was already telling you that, and you kind of knew that it wasn't working, you know, whatever it is that you were doing. But then when you have this chart that's legitimately in your face showing you this consistent kind of chronic stress type of cycle. And for example, I've worked with women where we look at all of the things, right? Like it's like they're working in conjunction with their healthcare practitioners to look at thyroid issues or adrenals or whatever. And there are times when literally like we can't find anything wrong with you except for your stressful situation. So for some women, it's the thing that gives them permission to look at it, because before it was in their head, it was like, you know, I know stress is a problem, but whatever. But then when you actually see it in your face on a physical piece of paper or a physical app, you know, chart on your app or something like that, then you're forced to look at it. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, I just count it as a blessing for myself that I've been charting all these years, and if I ever go off the rails or whatever, like I see it. I can't really go that far off the rails because it's right there in my cycle.
Yeah, exactly why. It's the fifth vital sign, right? Okay, yeah. So let's talk about this amazing book that you wrote called The Fifth Vital Sign. So tell listeners what this book is. Why did you write this? What is the purpose of it? What does it help women do?
Well, thank you for that. The reason that I wrote it is because I need a place to channel my frustration. I feel like there's two ways that you could address the frustration that you feel. I've been doing this for a long time. Every other day I hear another story of a woman who potentially had a really negative experience on birth control, was gaslighted by her practitioners, and ultimately didn't necessarily know that she had the power and the tools within her own self to basically improve her own health. And so, you know, you get me talking or whatever, and I get super angry and upset about the whole situation and the state of modern medicine and the way that it treats and dismisses women. So I started the podcast about 5 years ago, the Fertility Friday podcast, as a way, literally, when I started it, I was like, I wonder if anyone else cares. I know it affected my life. Does anyone else care? And it turned into its own thing. It got a lot bigger than I ever thought. And so the book was my way to contribute to the conversation. But fertility awareness is a newer, burgeoning field. It's not a well-established field, you know, to the extent of medicine or naturopathic medicine. And it's associated with the rhythm method. There's a lot of history there of people not thinking that it works, people not thinking that it's scientific. So my intention with the book was to create a resource. I know that I've attracted a lot of different women to me who are health professionals and who want the science. We're in a time now where, you know, we can't just be running our mouths about stuff. You really need to be backing up what you say with scientific references. And you have to do your research. You have to know what you're talking about. So with the fifth vital sign, I cited over 1,000, like it was a labor of love. It took 2 years to research and write. But I wanted to basically put that information in women's hands. You know, before we started our call, you know, you mentioned like, I had no idea about cervical mucus and how much detail there was. You know, there's a lot of most medical doctors don't know. Why is that not just taught in medical school? So a big motivation for me in writing the book and how I wrote the book was to literally like give people the information. You know, I had to learn this through the process of becoming a fertility awareness educator. It almost feels like this knowledge is kind of like behind closed doors. So I was trying to really, like, everyone needs to know it. Take this to give you the, like, the physical thing that I've been, you know, instead of me just talking all the time, now you have the book.
Well, and you achieved that. I mean, it's incredibly well written and researched. And while there are over 1,000 scientific studies cited in this book, it's not written in a way that it's like over your head.
Right. You know, it's easy to read.
It's easy to read. It's applicable to the average woman that would just pick this up and go, I want to learn more about my body. I want to learn more about my cycle. And I want to know what I can do to either, you know, prevent pregnancy naturally or achieve pregnancy naturally. There's so much information in this book. And so we thank you so very much for writing it. It's been, like we said, an awesome resource for us as well, especially to learn more about that wonderful cervical mucus that we just had no idea was so complex.
We're going to have to like count how many times we said mucus in this whole episode.
Yeah, it's going to turn into one of those words like moist, where exactly. Everybody hates like the oi sound. It's going to be like mucus.
A lot of women have an issue with calling, like, because I've been in this field so long and it's always TMI Wednesday or whatever day it is with me, and it rolls off the tongue. A lot of women don't like that word, you know, but to stay true with the research and what it is really, that's why I use that term, because it's what it is. And it's not a bad thing, because cervical mucus is amazing.
Yeah. Well, and there's all kinds of tissues throughout our body that produce what we would call mucus. There are things called mucus membranes in our bodies, like all over the place.
Yeah, it's a scientific term. And right. Like you were saying, like keeping with the scientific research, it is called cervical mucus. So
it is indeed.
We should embrace it and love it and have a new perspective around it.
Okay, so last question, Lisa. Give us, and we ask pretty much all of our podcast guests this, but give us your like one big piece of advice. What do you want women to take away from your book, from this interview? What should they know as they go forward on their fertility journey?
That's a good question. I would say that know that your menstrual cycle is a sign of health. And when I say menstrual cycle, I mean menstrual cycle with regular ovulation. Laura Bryden says all the time that, you know, ovulation is how we make our hormones. And that's exactly what it is, you know. So I would say know that your menstrual cycle as a reproductive age woman, you know, biological female with a uterus and all of that, know that it is a sign of health. And if you pay attention to it, then you can be privy even before, you know, your doctor can identify if there's an issue. It's like your own hidden superpower. So, you know, learn it, use it, live it, love it.
Yeah. And that goes for, you know, women who don't want to get pregnant and women who want to get pregnant. I feel like that, you know, a lot of women, they start learning their cycles when they finally want to get pregnant. And I think, you know, that's such a disservice to women. And we've mentioned a couple of times is that we really want young girls to be able to have like your book or Dr. Laura Bryden's book, like right when they turn 13 or like right when they get their period, so they can learn all about the amazing superpowers that their menstrual cycle has and that they're not ashamed of it and that they feel empowered moving forward and that they don't feel at the mercy of conventional medicine and birth control.
Well, and we didn't get into birth control at all, you know, but there's benefits to having a menstrual cycle, to ovulating, to producing your natural estrogen and progesterone. You get to keep your libido. I mean, even if you don't want to have kids.
The right? Bonus.
Yeah, we had Jolene Brighton on the podcast, and Jolene Brighton kind of, she went over the whole, we talked about beyond the pill. Yeah, we talked all about birth control. And, you know, if we had 3 hours to sit here and talk to you, I'd love to get into all of that as well. But thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your work. Absolutely check out Lisa's podcast. It's called Fertility Friday. She has some amazing guests on there and shares a ton of her knowledge and experience. Please pick up a copy of The Fifth Vital Sign. It's one of our favorite books. We have a growing library of all these amazing books that are coming out, and Lisa's definitely tops the charts. So The Fifth Vital Sign, pick that up. We'll have links to that in the podcast episode description as well as her podcast. Lisa, anything else you want to point listeners toward for your work? Anywhere else they can find you?
Well, the book's available on Amazon in ebook and paperback format. The audio should be coming out within a couple of weeks of the release of this. It's been interesting, but it's almost there. Just like waiting for it to be approved. Like, come on, Amazon. And for the listeners, you know, you can actually grab the first chapter of the fifth vital sign for free if you go to thefifthvitalsignbook.com. So
awesome. Well, thanks again, Lisa, for being here.
Thank you so much. I'm
very happy to have you.
Thank you for having me. This has been a blast.
All right, that's going to do it for this week. We're so happy that we could bring Lisa's work to you to help you learn more about your cycle and better understand your fertility. You can find links to Lisa's podcast, her book, and her social media on our website through the link in the episode description. And don't forget that we are doing a giveaway for her book, The Fifth Vital Sign, on our Instagram account. If you're listening to this before Saturday, May 4th, you still have a chance to enter and win a free copy. So head over to our Instagram account at tinyfeet.co and find our May 1st post announcing the podcast for instructions on how to enter that giveaway. We'll be announcing the winner in our stories on Saturday morning, May 4th. Also, be sure to download your Are You Healthy Enough to Get Pregnant quiz so that you can get started on identifying and addressing common health symptoms that might be affecting your fertility. You can find that link to the quiz also in the episode description. Lastly, we just want to invite you to join us over on Instagram and Facebook at tinyfeet.co and on YouTube at Mastering Your Fertility TV.